Blog Talk Radio.
Let the people know who weren't on board with us last week
about the overview, what you kind of laid as a foundation for the discussion today.
Okay, well, the short of it is, back in 1982, the Aserese Society was introduced to the Asante Kingdom through the personage of Nana Kwoko Sarpong, who was the paramount king of the Agogo traditional area of Asante. As he was representing his king, the Asante Hene Otumfo Opokuwari II, we were then invited, we hosted the king here. When he came, we held a Durba for him. He then invited us to go to Africa to celebrate with the Asante the 50th anniversary of the restoration of their confederacy, which had been disbanded in 1900 or so by the British as a result of the war that the British and Asante had fought, the last war. After doing so, we then developed a relationship with them, and our interest was as on multi-leveled, one, in linking with our people at home, especially those who are trying to support and promote and continue with the culture. As you know, the Aserese Society was created as a vehicle for those of us in the diaspora who wanted to do more than just study about Africa and the beauty of African culture and the history and all that, but wanted to try to apply these principles to our daily lives. So our principles and ideals are structured around the teachings of ancient Kemet, so-called ancient Egypt. And so we're always looking for liaisons with people on the continent who are in that same struggle of promoting and preserving traditional African culture, because it's been under assault for a long time, and in many cases it's virtually disappearing. But fortunately for us, at least the Asante have held on to this part of their kingship system.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of this relationship and my years of engaging with them and going back and forth, and my underarching or overarching desire to complete a educational process that I had put off back in the 70s, doing a doctoral dissertation, I was able to enroll in a college and university in Ghana and produce this thesis around the Asante Divine Kingship. And the exact title is the Asante Divine Kingship as a Model for Sustainable Development of Self and Community. And I chose to do it all around the kingship, one, because, again, we're practicing African divine kingship within the Aserese Society.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a personal linkage for me in that, I need to learn and apply and whatever I can gather and gain from whatever traditions we have that are viable, things that we can use and find the blends within our cultures. And then the Asante also trace their ancestry back to ancient Kemet, the ancient Northeast, and there's a lot of historical evidence to show that they were a part of that civilization, and we find linkages and documents and those kinds of things supporting that claim. And then to look at it from the standpoint of leadership in today's world, as we can see from what's going on around the world right now, the Western model of leadership is not working. People can argue and fuss and fight and debate all they want, but what we see is a world in chaos. And it's in chaos because of the Western model that's been superimposed on much of the rest of the world. The mess that's happening in the Middle East is a result of the United States and other Western powers going in there and superimposing their Western idea, or trying to superimpose the Western idea on those people. And so we have this clash of cultures and civilizations, all centered around this problem of leadership, the very problems of, if we extract the world conflicts, take the world conflicts out of the equation, just look at the conflicts within the United States itself in relationship to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when was the last time there was a bill that was passed through Congress? I mean, that wasn't a dire necessity.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time these people came together and decided what's best for the nation, as opposed to their own personal proclivities and wishes
mm-hmm.
and desires and petty political fights and carrying on. So
mm-hmm.
in looking at all of that, and if there is something of truly value in African culture, and since African people have historically, from the beginning of recorded history, always organized ourselves around the kingship model, that was why I decided to do this piece on the kingship of, and using the Asante because, again, they have preserved their kingship system, and I have familiarity with it and relationships with it, which gave me access to really kind of get into the nuts and bolts and the underneath currents of some
mm-hmm.
of the issues and some of the qualities and characteristics that the kingship presents.
You know, when we look at,
when
we look at African history, and then, you know, we fast forward to today, and you mentioned, you know, traveling back and forth, a lot of people who have never been to the continent of Africa, a lot of African Americans, quote, end quote, Africans in America, who have studied Africa, it's from a historical standpoint. When you went travel back, I mean, you're not visiting, I mean, you're visiting a continent with a very rich and vast history, but the people there are living today. I mean, there is a today Africa, you know. So when you travel back and forth, and having read so much and studied so much yourself even about African history, and then you travel there today and see the current Africa and see the descendants of the people that you may have read about that are still living there and still functioning there and have a system that they're being, you know, that they're functioning under, that's got to be something for you to be, you know, to bridge this time thing. Has it ever felt like you were traveling back in time when you visit the motherland?
Well, it used to. But today,
okay.
much of Africa is suffering from the same kinds of challenges and issues that the rest of the world is suffering from, simply because the Western model has been forced on Africa as well. And so a lot of the cultural and historical qualities of the culture and the people are being gradually eroded, and such that in many cases, unless you kind of you can hang out in some cities and not know that you're outside of, you might think you're in Harlem or someplace. The kind of things that you'll witness, the growth, and then the same issue with in terms of the politics that's taking place. We talk about the challenge of the Western model of leadership here. Well, the same thing is taking place on the continent relative to the Western model that's been forced upon them. Specifically, I can speak more specifically about Ghana, because that's
mm-hmm.
where, you know, I've been spending most of my time. But the same kinds of challenges that we see here in the U.S. with Democrats and Republicans having their little petty issues, you see that in amongst the political party system in Ghana as well. Because the political party system by nature, a part of the Western model of leadership, unfortunately by nature, is adversarial, which is in direct contradiction to the traditional African political system, which was through the kingship system. which was cooperative in terms of approaching issues, et cetera. So if you have an adversarial posture from the beginning, you can only expect that there to be adversarial responses within the political system. And you see a lot of that. The same kind. You remember when Bush versus Gore, how when the people in Florida, they were trying to count and the Republicans busted in and stopped the count, that they're on the brink of violence before the Supreme Court stepped in and took the election. Well, in Ghana and other parts of Africa, that brink of violence actually moves to violence through this contest, of the political system. And so when I was talking to a lot of people when I was doing this research, and I was talking about the challenges and the importance of the kingship, et cetera, and the research bore out that many of them wish that and want that the principles and talent and precepts of the kingship could be woven back into the foundation of the government, the Western model of government as well. And it is possible. There are things there that could happen and things there that could need to happen, and they see it needs to happen, but it's a long road to hoe.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you think about and look at the West and the separation of church and state, and then you look at African culture, which historically, you know, when you talk about spirituality, is woven into the very fabric of the society, then you see a vast difference in even approaching challenges. So if you don't mind, could you talk about just the African model versus the separation of church and state model system, shall I say, that breeds, like you mentioned just a moment ago, that whole approach to solving problems? Because we're taught that, you know, we are, in fact, if God is the ocean, we're the drop, but we have the same qualities and the characteristics and potential as God. And when you separate man from God, then ultimately the separation of church and state is bound to follow. So could you talk about just that African model of spirituality being woven into the very society that governs the people versus in contrast to the separation of church and state system?
Well, as we said a while ago, historically, from the beginning of recorded history, when we look at Africa and its political organization, the model, it's been the divine kingship, called the divine kingship because it is a linkage between God and man. God is looked upon as the designer and the creator and the giver of all life and energy. And as such, man then becomes the caretaker of that which the Supreme Being has provided. Matter of fact, when we look back into ancient Kemet, and we see that the whole principle and the goal of each person's life was to awaken their divinity, to become a God-man or a God-woman on earth. Well, the king was referred to as a God-king. So the concept of separating God from life is an oxymoron within the traditional African context. It's impossible to separate. It's like taking wet out of water. Or dry out the sand, you know.
Sweetness out of sugar.
So, you know, you can't do it within traditional Africa, and the kingship model was practiced all over Africa, and when we study historically, we find that people all over the continent organize themselves around this kingship model, the divine kingship model. And the kingship model was something that provided for, yeah, the king was one person. And the king might have come, or in most cases did come, from a royal family. I mean, a family of people that whose responsibility was to develop and cultivate themselves to the highest level that they can become the focal point for the Supreme Being, or the means through which the Supreme Being guides the people. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just limited access and guidance and positions of importance and prominence weren't just limited to royals. You know, you find that to run a nation, you have to have a cadre of people. And when we find, when we study the history of African political systems, we find that, yeah, there's the king, but there's also counselors, there's also people that handle finances, people, there's military people, a whole cadre of mm-hmm. people who are responsible and given positions, not because necessarily of their birth, but because of their character and quality, which is the foundational principle that determines leadership within traditional Africa. You know, what is the character and quality of this person? If this person has a questionable character, then they're not given positions of authority and responsibility. And it wasn't just limited, as we said, just to royalty, but even in traditional Africa, for example, in Ghana, historically, even slaves were oftentimes promoted to positions of authority within the kingdom. Mm. So there's several wow. instances where there were slaves within the Asante kingdom who were given, one man was given the title of Jasehine, who's the chief financial officer, basically, within mm-hmm. the kingdom system. And this man had been a slave of one of the kings. Another slave had been a great warrior in battle and was given political positions. So we find that character and quality and closeness and mimic of God is the real defining value, set of values that are determined, are used to determine who should be a leadership in leadership position. And then we also look at the, you know, there's still this, in America, there's still this glass ceiling that many people can't get through. If you're not a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male, then many times you're marginalized within the society. And that's true with Western culture. You know, it mm-hmm. wasn't, when this country was created, you know, they talk about creative, all men were created equal, but they meant just that, all men. And by men, they meant only white men who own property. So mm-hmm. if you were a white man who didn't own anything, if you were a white woman, if you were a person of color, any color, you didn't qualify as a part of this perfect union that was established. But within traditional Africa, as far back as recorded history, in ancient Kemet and through contemporary and more recent Africa, we find that women have always been given political positions on par with the men. As a matter of fact, as we discussed last week in ancient Kemet, as well as in traditional Asante, it's the woman, the queen mother, who determines who the leader of the nation should be, who the king should be. Mm-hmm. It's the woman, the king's relationship or ability to rule, I should say, is based on his relationship to the woman. So the women then have political power equivalent, in some cases more elevated than even mm-hmm. men. And there's been historical instances where, in ancient Kemet, for example, Hatshepsut ruled as a king mm-hmm. because there were no men of quality. And then in Ghana, back in the 1700s, there was also a period of time where there was a queen mother, Nana Aben Serwa, who ruled Jabin, which is one of the eight original states, members of the Asante Confederacy. And not only did she rule it, but her daughter ruled it and her granddaughter ruled it because mm-hmm. of the challenges with the males in the royal family. So women have never, and then when you look at the king, the structure, you have the chief or the king, then you have his counselors and advisors and sub-chiefs, etc. Well, the same parallel system exists on the female side. So you have the queen mother and her counselors, advisors, and then sub-chiefs, etc. So African women within the kingship model within traditional Africa have always been given equal par with their male counterparts, historically and even contemporarily.
You know, even with that, that would suggest to me that that same dynamic would carry over into relationships, you know, just because if, for example, there's a queen mother that's ruling the region, then it would be difficult for a man to view women, to have a very low opinion of women if, in fact, the women or the woman at that particular time was the king, you know, or, you know, if everybody knew that a woman who was qualified could very easily hold a position that was elevated, you know, as it were, to a position of a man. So just even that equality in the political system would have to carry over, I would assume, into personal relationships like marriage and, you know, just even dealing with that sort of thing. Whereas here, for example, we're yet to have a woman president, you know, and I'm not sitting up here advocating for one at all. I'm just saying that we haven't had one here. And there are people that are opposed to that just based on the gender. I mean, not even taking into consideration any of the any qualifications or anything, et cetera, just by virtue of the fact of the gender. But back to my point, it seems as though just that whole attitude towards women being equal on par with men would have to have carried over into relationships as well.
Oh, yeah. So you find that within traditional Africa, women not only, when you go to the marketplace, for example, in Africa, the marketplace is largely ran by women. And those are, they're not working for their husbands. Those are, they have their own businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So the economy, the political, the social, women have on par with men throughout the social structure. And so you don't have, of course, there's going to be issues, gender issues, wherever you are. But in terms of they're not like here where you women are and literally second-class citizens at home and within the political system. Whereas women control their own destiny, for the most part, within traditional African structure. Now, the Western model has created some inequalities within Africa as well, simply because many families, because of the advent of Western education and because of the cost of Western education, and because of the man's responsibility to, in order to marry someone, it's a pricey expenditure. It's a pricey cost. The man has to come up with, you know, a significant investment to promote, to give to the family of the woman. So a lot of families had deferred their girls from education because they couldn't afford for boys and girls to go. So you have this political educational class thing that's developed through the advent of the Western superimposition of the Western model on the traditional systems, traditional culture. But beyond that, you know, in the traditional system, in the traditional societal, women were equal, and in many cases were quote unquote in a higher position than many men. So in looking at the divine kingship, though, from and the its movement or the role, we mentioned that the royals, the families, the kings and queen mothers all are part of the royal families. And in many cultures, many communities, there could be three different families, all of which trace their ancestry back to a common woman from whom the leaders are selected, the stools are selected. But we also have historically that many cases where people who are non-royals were given stools, as well as many instances. For example, there's a historical study that was done in Ghana of 212 stools. They found that 36 of them fired by non-royals. So that's about 15%
mm-hmm.
or so occupied by non-royals.
Wow.
And of those 212, 55 of those stools had at some point been occupied by, even of the royal stools, were occupied by non-royals, because there were no non-royals, I mean royals, who were qualified to lead. So people who were not of the royal families were put in those positions. So again, this all leads back to the understanding that in Africa, traditional Africa, it's the character of the person that's most important. And that character has to do with their connection to and their reflection as a divine being, even though they may not use that term, but they have within their culture these concepts and ideals about man's relationship with God and how close man needs to be with God. Because we talked about the king being a representative of the supreme being within the context of the community. Well, there's an Akan proverb which says that God is king. So even what they're saying here is that, you know, ultimately it's the spirit world, spirit beings that are the founders of the culture, of the land, and the rulers. And so the humans then have a relationship with the spiritual world, and therefore are able to guide and rule the people. Now, within the context of the African or the Asante model, when we talk about the spiritual underpinning of the political system, we see that the king and they refer to the rulers of the provinces within the Asante kingdom as chiefs. We refer to them as kings, but you know that's another issue. So they call their king the head of all the people. And again, the Asante are a group of people who came together but united to fight a common enemy. And so they selected one of amongst their equals as to be the head of the whole nation. So these were all equal kings in their own right, who, because of their weakness, decided that to become strong. They didn't decide, actually. They were guided spiritually by one of the most famous of the priests of ancient Asante, Akonfenoche, to understand that if they were going to overcome the plight that they were having with this other group of people who were subjugating them, they would have to spiritually come together and unite as one. And they gave up their autonomy so that the king of the current Asante Henny, that position, the king who was the king of Kumasi, now became the king of Asante, could rule the whole nation. And as a part of that process, of that spiritual unification process, the chief priest, Akonfenoche, caused a golden stool to descend from the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And before he came down, he said that whichever of the eight kings that were there, whoever lapped the stool or lighted on, would become the ruler of the nation, or the one among the first among equals, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so it lighted on Otumfo Osei-Tutu, the first's lap. So he became the first Asante Henny and unified the people. And that was the beginning of the Asante kingdom, and eventually became the empire. But historically, we'll discuss some of those historical issues that took place. But the main point I want to emphasize here is that this is why the Asante look upon their kingship as being a divine kingship, because it was God who sent them through his priest, the Konfanochi, who sent them the golden stool. And it was through this spiritual process that the people united and were able to come together and become define their own destiny or choose their own destiny or guide their own destiny, as opposed to being subjugated by others around them. So then the Santi kingship, as traditional kingships in Africa, we could say is a theocratic model of rulership, in that it's based on God, it's based on the spiritual foundation that God is the energy and the material basis of all things, and it's through God manifestation that we receive everything we got. And therefore, God and his subordinates, what are called the divinities, are then the rulers of the kingdom, along with the ancestors who were the first people to inhabit the land and develop the land, etc. So there's these layers of spiritual underpinning that the king represents and that those in ruling positions represent by the and for within the system itself.
So the king, as God's representative, for lack of a better term, or administrator in the earth for that particular group or region, is he, again, since he's being viewed as as king and as one with God, is he also the spiritual leader? Because I know they have priests as well, in the country, in the region, I'm sure they're priests as well. So is he viewed as the spiritual leader as well as the political leader? I mean, do those two titles merge together, those two functions? Is he guiding as a political leader as well as the spiritual leader?
Yes, he is also the chief priest. He's responsible for preserving and making sure that the spiritual practices, the rituals of the kingdom are preserved and maintained and move forward. So he's also then the spiritual head, even though, as you say, there are people who are trained as priests themselves who take the lead in terms of many of the spiritual underpinnings and spiritual practices. It's the king's responsibility as the chief priest to make sure that these things then. So he has his own roles and his own rituals that he also has to do in order to keep the kingdom in spiritual balance, so to speak.
Okay.
So when we talk about this, we have to talk about it from the, when we talk about spirituality in the African sense, we're talking about it from the perspective of there's two aspects of being. There's consciousness, and then there's spirit. Our ancestors in ancient Kemet referred to the spirit as Ra. So Ra represents all of the energy matter that's been manifested on whatever level, metaphysical and physical, which is what spirit is. Consciousness is that aspect of being through which perceives reality. Spirit is that aspect of being which acts upon reality. So spirit is our vehicle of expression. Consciousness sees what we need to do. Spirit is what we use to accomplish what we need to do. So within the context of the African understanding of spirit, then you have these different levels or gradations of spirit. There's an axiom that we hear oftentimes people say in when they're talking about spiritual culture, as above, so below. And what that means is that the same way we have a hierarchy and relationships within the physical world, so too do the same kind of hierarchy and relationships exist in the spiritual world and vice versa. So let's use the example of the body. We have a body, Now, we could just say we have a body and be done with that. But beginning in ancient Kemet, there was a whole process of a whole scientific process of identifying different parts of the body and understanding how it functions, how it works, etc., so we can become more specific. You just go to the doctor and say, my body hurts, the doctor's not going to be able to do much for you. But if you go into the doctor and say, my leg hurts, or my ankle hurts, or my knee hurts, then we have something that we can work with.
Mm-hmm.
So the importance of understanding hierarchy and structure and anatomy, for lack of a better word, is it just as important as it is on the physical world, is also as important in the spirit world, meaning that there's the body of God, and which is also man's body, which we call spirit or Ra. But this body is just not, it's not a glob of just energy matter. It has its own functional parts, each of which has its their own role to play. Just like in the body of the human body, we have cells, millions, billions of different cells, many of which have different functions, all working toward the common goal of the body's expression. So too it is in the spirit world. We have different spiritual forces, different spiritual expressions, all of which have their own particular role to play, but all they work together as a part of the unification of the common approach to God and man working within the world itself. So when in Africa we hear people talk about spirits, well, we only talk about spirits because English lacks the sophistication to really break down the spirit world. Western culture doesn't have the nomenclature for spiritual exploration simply because Western culture hasn't really understood what spirit is to be able to break it down. They've gone in, they can tell you what each atom making up a molecule of gold does, and differentiate that from silver, differentiate that from copper. But when you get into the spirit world, it's just spirit. It's just like saying gold and rock and copper and diamond is just rock. No, these are different rocks, and they all have different values. So in the spirit world, you have different levels of spirit, which each of which has its own particular role and function within the body, the overall spiritual body. Now,
well, you know what's interesting, Orwai, is that when, you know, growing up here in the West, we've been taught, actually, whether it's just, I mean, not necessarily in a school setting, but, you know, it's just come upon us to think that the spirit is to maybe the Western mind what consciousness is to the African mind. Because, you know, when you think of, okay, you mentioned earlier consciousness and then energy matter. And consciousness is consciousness, that's which perceives. And energy matter is spirit. Well, again, people in the West have been brought up to think that spirit is not energy matter, that it's not matter at all, that it's not solid, that it's, you know, it's invisible, it's this invisible thing, you know, with no matter at all, you know what I mean? Not even really any energy, you know, just kind of like this invisible something, you know, and that's spirit, you know, because people say when you die, your spirit leaves you, you know what I mean? And so that's what's been given to us. And now when you say that, okay, consciousness is that which perceives, we've been taught, almost taught, that spirit is that which perceives. So now there has to be a whole new retraining, and I can actually see how, just having this discussion, how different cultures have difficulty even understanding the mind or the thought process of another, from another culture, when the whole foundation upon which the whole world view is different. For example, we talk about, I know an ancient saying is, an ancient Kemetic saying is, Anuk Oser, you know, I am Oser, Well, in the West, we're taught to fear God. I am God, you know, but to fear God. So even, could you talk about that in terms of the spiritual aspect of just even relating to the world around you? If you feel that you are one with God, then you're a part of all that God created and not separate from the elements.
Okay, well, we can look at it from this perspective. Western science is moving toward the understanding of spirit as the energy matter of the world itself. There's a concept within Western science, and we'll discuss this kind of sort of later when we talk about the environment, called Gaia, which is saying that as the earth is a spirit, has a spirit, is a breathing entity. And when we talk about traditional peoples, indigenous cultures all over the world, they talk about the spirit of the earth or the spirit of the heavens or whatever. That the Western mind is beginning to grasp that this thing that we call the world, I mean, it's based on Einstein's theory. If you say that E equals MC squared, meaning energy equals matter times a constant, then what they're saying is energy and matter are really the same thing. It's just we perceive them on different levels. And that energy matter is what we call, in the African context of indigenous cultures, refer to as spirit. So when we talk about the spirit of the water, we're talking about water is a vibrational expression of spirit. It's a programmed expression of spirit. All energy, all spirit is programmed. Spirit works within the context of its organization. Water is going to be water. Fire is going to be fire. Wind is going to be wind. These things are all programmed to do what they do. And and within the African context, then these forces that what we call the forces of nature are given personifications so that we can then classify them and discuss them from in a certain way in the perspective. It's like saying if you want to if you have an insurance policy, right, and your insurance policy covers this, this, and this, but it does not cover acts of God. Well, what do they mean? What's an act of God? I mean, it's a it's a spiritual expression, a spiritual experience that is taking place that your policy doesn't cover. So a flood might be an act of God. Well, in the Western sense, that sense they're saying an act of God. In the traditional African sense, is God acting through the water, or is God acting through the wind, or is God acting through the river? It's God, because the spirit is the vehicle through which consciousness, which is the consciousness of Supreme Being, acts. It's the same consciousness within man. So our spirit is identical with that of God. Our consciousness is identical with that of God. In the same way that the divine consciousness works through the forces of nature, so too does our consciousness, when we are able to tap into it, act on the same principle of this divinity. So when we say that man is a divine being, we're saying that man and God are identical in terms of quality. So the spiritual force that man can muster may not be the same as, in terms of quantity, as that of the Supreme Being, but the quality of that expression is one and the same. And we find the same concept within the Asante system, in the Asante culture. You know, the idea that the people are representatives of the spirit world and guide the spirit world, and that the goal of each person is to become a divine being, one with God, is represented in a Kante concept and practice that is virtually extinct today. There was a man named Rattray. He was an English man who went and lived back in the 1920s and 30s or so, after the British defeated militarily the Asante and began to move in to establish with the missionaries, et cetera, and establish a governance, a colonizer, governance over the Asante. There was a British man named Rattray who came in as a social scientist, basically. And he, unlike many other Westerners, he came in with an open mind to study and learn the Asante culture. And the Asante today appreciate Rattray so much in terms of what he did, even though in his language he had some typical Western kinds of phrases, like one of his books is entitled Proverbs or something of a savage people or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when he wrote about the Asante, was that he made specific point of referencing that the missionaries and the Western people came into Asante, did Asante an injustice in terms of casting all of their spiritual practices and beliefs as pagan, heathen, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes in and he studies, and he lives amongst the Asante, and he studies their practices. And he comes out with and produces work, a number of books, which show the spiritual philosophy underpinning many of the Asante practices as being on par with, or even in some cases, superior to the Western model.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that Western spirituality, we're talking about those that came in with Christianity and Islam. So within, there's a process, the supreme being in Asante is called Enyame.
Mm-hmm.
And now Rattray translates Enyame as the sky god, but when you read the understanding, they're not talking about the sky god. They refer to Enyame as dwelling in heaven, like we refer to God as being in heaven.
Right.
So, you know, it's the God that dwells in heaven. But he also talked about within we're talking about the 1920s and 30s or so, that there was this place called the Temple of Enyame,
mm-hmm.
The Temple of God. And this was not just a place. This was something that was throughout the kingdom. There were temples of Enyame. And there were priests who were dedicated to Enyame throughout the kingdom. And there was this concept of, shrine, for lack of a better word, called Enyame Dua, which was in every compound, I mean, every family household had this Enyame Dua shrine there. And it wasn't really a shrine. What it was an altar. And there was it's a tree that's called Enyame Dua, which is called God's tree. And they would take a branch of this tree, they would cut it, they would put it in the ground, and they would cut it such that at the top of it, there was a three-pronged kind of fork so that a bowl or a pot could sit at the top of it. So you had the branch was in the ground, and at the top there were three branches off of this branch that created this, mm-hmm. like, holder for this basin.
Mm-hmm.
And this shrine, or this altar, was called Enyame Dua. And the basin then would be there and would collect rainwater. And or sometimes people would go to the river and get water and put it in this pot. And
mm-hmm.
every household in Asante had one. Now, I haven't seen one. And I've been through a lot of households today. But that's not the important part. The most important part was what took place with this altar. Now, again, Enyame, the name Enyame is the name for the supreme being. So this is God's altar, basically,
mm-hmm.
God's tree. And so the concept was when rain would fall or they would gather water from the stream, this is a gift from God. And so they would
mm-hmm.
use the water that was in this altar to they would bathe with it, or they would, if someone was sick or going through a painful birth, they would give them this water. So it was that they had healing properties, right? It was spiritual water, basically, holy water. But every day then, each person would go to this pot, they would dip their finger in the pot, and they would create a circle in the middle of their forehead with the water while they meditated on what it is that they needed to do to become one with God.
Mm. Wow.
This process is called Enyamisuo, which means the character of God.
Mm-hmm.
So every day, every morning, a person would go to that pot and circle, take some water, dip it on their finger, and sit there and visualize what they need to do in their daily life to become at one with God.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the, because within the Asante system, the cultural values of the system, to sin is to sin against God. Right? So everyone wanted to become above sin, beyond sin. They wanted to be one with God. They didn't want to be a sinner. They wanted to be at one with God. And so every morning they would do this. Now, there's a lot of people who do different things with the forehead, spiritual things, right?
True.
When the priest is Catholic priest is giving a child their, you know, their, what's your name? They put the sprinkle of the water on the forehead.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the role? What's the value? What's the meaning of this? And when we look back at ancient Kama, we find that there is a direct link between the forehead or the head, the forehead, and this concept called kente.
Hmm.
Now, within, within the Asante, this Enyamisuo that they would practice is to put them at one with God. So within the Kemetic system, there's this thing called kente, which represents the forehead.
Okay.
And kente also represents values like there's a kintu, which means the dwellers in the most sacred places in heaven. So you see that this concept of the forehead in kente is connected with the divinity. There's kente amenta. Amenta is a term for heaven within the Kemetic language. So it's again talking about the spiritual basis, the subconscious basis of kente and the role that the forehead represents in that. There's all these different terms for kente, variations of kente, all of which are talking about how the forehead is the seat of God within man.
Mm.
Now, in other cultures, in the Indus Valley traditions, you have what's called the Ajna Center, right, which is supposedly the chakra, the Ajna chakra, where enables one to consciously communicate with through the spirit world, etc. But in Kemet, there was these practices where the person would actually do these visualizations and meditations, focusing on the forehead, in order to connect them with the Supreme Being. Just as in Asante, the practice was going on. The Okra, which is the concept of that spark of the God which dwells within man, is resident within the head. But even more so importantly, is that science has shown now that this is just not some superstitious or practice that has no functional relationship. Now, we could just say that, well, that's just, you know, something that somebody came up with, superstitious, that they've been practicing for years and years and years. Just pat the forehead, put something on the forehead, and supposedly there's this spiritual thing that's happening. Well, the forehead is also the seat of what's called the prefrontal cortex of the brain. And the prefrontal cortex is the most recent development of man's brain, or to say say another way, it's the youngest brain within our being. And since the youngest brain is also the weakest brain, it only began to develop and grow around 100,000 years ago as speech and language began to be developed within man coming out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these other parts of the brain, the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain, all of which have these characteristics that we see reflected within behaviors within people. You know, the reptilian brain, amongst other things, is responsible. When we think about reptile, we think about a snake as a primal example.
Mm-hmm.
Snakes, lizards, those kinds of creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the concept of dominating or dominance or aggression, seeking out sex and a mate, rigidity, compulsiveness, all fear, submission, greed, all these are expressions that function out of the reptilian part of the brain. Then you have the mammalian part of the brain, or the limbic part of the brain, which is the part of the brain through which feelings and emotions reside or function within us. So we have anger and other emotional so-called expressions that operate out of these animal parts of the brain. Now, if this was all that we had operating going on for us, then we would see within the world, maybe this is all we have going on within us. We would see within the world behaviors that are reflective of these animal parts in our brain, right?
And we do.
Hello. Right now, there's a whole debate about whether or not the quote-unquote, how we should respond to the quote-unquote terrorists in the Middle East, right? You know, the concept of aggression and response and dominance and that reptilian brain is what guides Western man's response primarily. The first war within the Middle East was after that. So we see Trump leading in the polls because he says we're going to take our country back, which is saying what? We're going to become dominant. That's that snake brain that's communicating. And people are linking in with that on a visceral level. So that is the brain that's dominant, the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain. These animal brains, unfortunately, are dominant within most people within Western culture. Now, we also have the neocortex, which is the human part of the brain, but you know, that's the part through which language and those kinds of things operate. But unfortunately, the language and the intellectual capabilities that the neocortex offers are being undergirded and manipulated by the animal brain. So the language that comes out is the snake talking. So the question about whether or not the old biblical story about whether or not snakes talk, yeah, they talk every day. This will turn your TV. So that part of the brain is controlled by this animal brain. Now, but the prefrontal cortex, which is the newest part of the brain, as we're saying, the youngest part of the brain, is the part of the brain which, among other things, is to give man the ability to control emotions and responses to these kinds of things. So it's the basis of morality and spirituality. It's the basis, it's the brain through which these levels of action and act behaviors are the manifest, selflessness. All these kinds of things are controlled or are developed by and through the prefrontal cortex. So then its responsibility is to control the animal, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk about the parable about controlling the beast, this is what's being talked about. It's this part of the brain is responsible for controlling the beast. That's the lower parts of the brain that dictate man's behavior in many cases. So for man to grow spiritually, man has to control the beast within him. So this the so-called devil, the 666, really the beast brain that is ruling man because it operates on an 18-breath cycle, which is 666. So this 18 breaths per minute through which the animal brains, the reptilian and mammalian brains operate, must be controlled by the prefrontal cortex. And how do we tap in and manipulate the prefrontal cortex? By lowering the breath, going into the alpha state and the beta state of brain waves, so that now the prefrontal cortex can gain control of the animal brain. And science has shown that when one meditates, that it strengthens the prefrontal cortex. The brain grows, the prefrontal cortex grows, it develops more gray matter, it develops more folds in the brain, which increase the brain's operation. So it gives people the ability to control these emotions and sensations and urges from the animal brain. And so when the Asante man was, or woman, went to in Nyame Duo and performed in Nyame Su, meditating on the center of the forehead, visualizing themselves being one with God, they were practicing the exact same practice that our ancestors in ancient Kemet established years ago. But the scientific basis now, science is showing that this practice of meditating on the center of the forehead and developing and cultivating the prefrontal cortex of the brain is the key to developing morality and spirituality and selflessness and these higher principles and values.
Well, what would you say then to people, because there are a lot of people now who are meditating in different systems. I mean, not even considering the fact of whether or not they are human or divine. They may even adhere to the fact that they are human. They may say, yes, I'm a human being. You know, no, I'm not divine, you know, and meditate. I mean, really sit down and meditate religiously. If you could talk about the importance of meditating with the correct information, because what you're taking into meditation is just as important as meditating. I mean, so if you could talk about the importance of meditating with the knowledge,
well,
in the knowledge that you are divine, because you could think you're human and meditate, and it might have some benefit, but you won't get the maximum benefit that you would if, for example, you took into meditation the thought that you were divine, or even say, let's talk about the law of Ma'at, that God needs me to come into the world, and fulfilling God's need is the highest act of love.
That's a very good point, in that there are people who meditate, visualize, so they can become a better tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Phil Jackson had his basketball teams visualizing themselves becoming a better team, being better basketball players.
Right.
You circumscribe the extent of your reach based on what you focus, how you see yourself. If you see yourself as only being a human, then without some exterior influence and guidance, you will probably only reach and strive to be a human. So that's where spiritual initiation comes in. That,
okay,
you know, within our context, now let's look at, we're talking about Asante 100 years ago, where within the culture itself, there were practices that the people engaged in that were directly focused on becoming one with God. Vis-a-vis where we are today, and in, because this practice of Nyame Su, there's many people I spoke to as I was doing this research who'd never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about this altar that Nyame Duo that every household had. I haven't seen one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now you have people, as a result of Western religious philosophy, Christianity and Islam, who are accepting the idea that they are a sinner by nature. Not that they can
mm-hmm.
overcome sin, not that they can become one with God and be sin-free, but that they're a sinner by nature. So
mm-hmm.
we have these issues of wherein, and this is a part of the cult, and let me just give you some statistical data that we were able to pull out.
Okay.
We mentioned that with the defeat of the military defeat of the Asante, and we already talked about how the British did not win the war because they didn't get the object of the war, which was the Golden Stool. They did militarily subdue the Asante, though.
Okay.
And so at that point, up until that point, missionaries had been barred from participating in the Asante. There were a couple of Asante that had been siphoned off, taken to Europe, to England, and trained and sent back, but they had minimal influence. The majority of people, we'll say 99% of the people, were practicing traditional Asante religion.
Okay.
As of 1900. As
okay.
soon
wow.
as the king, as Asante was defeated and the king was exiled, the governor sent a message to all the missionaries. The missionaries primarily were on the coast of Ghana. They weren't in the interior. The Santis dwelled in the interior. So at that point, the governor sent a cable, communicate to the missionaries that were on the coast. Asante is now open for missionary work.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about the 1900s, so a little more than 100 years ago. So at that point, we'll just say that 99%, just to be safe, 99% of the Asante view themselves, if you were to ask them, they would be practicing traditional Asante religion.
Okay.
As of 2010, that number had dropped in the census that were taken, that number had dropped to around 3-5% of people
wow.
who said that they were practicing traditional Asante religion. That was 2000, I'm sorry. As of 2010, it was less than 1%. Of the people who checked that box on their survey. Now,
wow.
There are some caveats that we can put in there to kind of skew the numbers. There are people who left the day than they were 20, 30 years ago who will classify themselves as Christian, but who still will practice some Asante traditional beliefs. They go to the shrine or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it's far less than it was 20, 30 years ago. So when we say that 1%, less than 1%, classify themselves as traditionalists, it's not many more than that were. And so this is the impact that the acceptance of these Western, the colonizers, at their values has had on the culture itself.
Well, what do you think is part of that reason? Because there are people who might think that, I mean, I can imagine certain Africans thinking that if the West is supposed to be, you know, the land of the free and, the land of opportunity, you know, and if for whatever reason, if where they are, you know, depending on the lifestyle that they're living, the Asante are living, talking about just in terms of whether they're, you know, living in affluence or relative poverty, then if they think that the West is, you know, the land of plenty, it would be easy, possibly, for them to think that, well, then maybe the God that they serve, you know, is smiling upon them or whatever, and then maybe if we get in tight with this God, then that can improve our condition too, because maybe the old ways, for lack of a better term, isn't working because, you know, we're still hungry or we're still, not that all Asante are hungry, but, you know, just, you know, generally speaking, they may feel that, okay, the West has so much or has been put up as having so much to offer. This is the place everybody wants to come. So maybe that might have something to do with it.
That has a lot to do with it. I mean, the whole Western education, the indoctrination, the marginalization of traditional values, you know, traditional religion and practices are seen as backward, superstitious, etc. Which is why we're doing this work, because we want to show people in general that there is scientific basis and value to many of the spiritual practices of indigenous peoples, African peoples, ancient Kamet, Asante, etc. So this is just a little example that we just talked about in terms of how science is proving that meditation, the visualization, etc., has an effect on empowering the brain, the part of the brain that it leads to spiritual cultivation and development, is one thing. I mean, there's a lot of more thing, a lot additional other things that we discussed and discovered through the course of this research that will do that. And the traditionalists are eager to do this because they see the effect of the Western culture has had on the culture in general, on society in general. And they all are looking for, realizing that, you know, 50 years ago, we didn't have these problems when we were practicing our own ways. When we started accepting the ways of the West, then we become problems just like the ways of the West. So the idea that, and this is another important point, because, you know, with the traditional, the missionaries who came in, as we talked about earlier, classified the African spiritual philosophy as heathen, pagan, etc. You know, they worship all these pagan saints and gods and whatever. Well, there was a process. There was a in terms of Rattray's discussion, he interviewed a priest. And he asked his priest, essentially, why do you worship, quote-unquote, these divinities? And the priest said that you can't just focus on the head. You have to look at the whole body, basically. I'm paraphrasing the conversation. Meaning, whereas the Western model focuses on the Godhead and just ignores everything else, the traditional African model understood that the spirit of God is a body. It's a whole body. And you can't just focus on the head. You have to exercise all aspects of the body. Now, what has happened, unfortunately, far too often, is that the Godhead part, I guess we're talking about this Nyamisu ritual, et cetera, that was going on, has become extinct within the practices. So, unfortunately, within traditional practices, too much, too little of the Godhead is really forced as discussed and practice. And we'll discuss some more of that as we go through further into the discussion. But, you know, it's understanding that spirit is a body. God's body is the world, the spirit world. The earth is a part of that, as well as all the other areas and manifestations of metaphysical reality, all part of God's body. And so you just can't focus on one aspect of it. You have to look at the whole, and you have to understand and learn to work through the whole, because that's what leads us to the fullness and expression of our potential. You know, for God to become a divine being means that I'm able to access and manipulate whatever level of spirit I need to accomplish whatever it is I need to accomplish. And if I shoot anywhere less than that, then I'm always going to find myself coming up short. And,
you know,
I
think it's
what we have.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think that's a beautiful concept, not just a concept, a reality, you know, that African culture has to become one with God. And I think that one of the problems, major problems, with translating that into Western thought is the fact that there are certain words, certain ideas that cannot be, that there are no words for. So I think that therein lies part of the difficulty when it came to Western man trying to understand, and even when they thought they understood and would write books upon, you know, African culture and African, you know, civilization and so forth, there were certain things that were just totally missed altogether, just simply because there was no word for whatever idea or concept they were trying to translate, and so they may have just picked up the next best thing. You know, well, I don't have a word for this, so I'll just come as close as I can to it in my language, which could be completely off still.
And that's giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, like if you show me some calculus, and I have no clue what you're talking about. Right? But then I'm going to make up something. You don't know what the heck you're talking about. You don't know anything about math simply because I don't understand it.
Right.
So therein lies, if I'm so arrogant, if I believe that you have nothing of value simply because what you have doesn't look like what I have, and then I'm going to minimize and denigrate what you have, and if I can convince you that what you have is of no value, and that you become then a part of your own self-denigration, then you become a mini-me with the same issues and problems that I have, not realizing that what you had was far beyond better than what I presented to you.
And I think that one of the proofs that even comes down to an article that I was reading recently about how you have many people in Africa, not just Ghana, but all over the continent, you are seeing a decline in the parents giving their children African names, that there's an increase in Africans naming their children, giving, you know, their children Western names. And that's, you know, I guess proof of what you're saying.
Yeah, that was a part of the process. I mean, people. Now there's a lot of things going on now. We talked about how, and we looked at the history of the culture through three periods. So there was the pre-colonial period, the colonial period, and then there's the post-colonial period. Now, during the colonial period, this is when, you know, the British were had come in and established a colonial governor and governance over the Santé. Was the beginning of this whole thing of people moving toward Christianity. And many people began to move toward Christianity because of problems that they had within the colonial system itself. You know, the colonial system that was practiced was one of putting people in place that would become the minions of the colonizer. And so many people were put in place, became chiefs, because not because they had any right to that position, but because the colonial government, a colonial governor, in order to control the people, took people out of their rightful stools and put false people in and called them the chief. And the people, many people resented that. And so the people who resented that became part of that resentment became fuel for a divide and conquer kind of scenario when Ghana became an independent state, right? So there was this many of the chiefs that were ruling during the colonial period were not rightful chiefs.
Okay,
and so there was a movement. Many people wanted to abolish and get rid of these puppet chiefs, and so they saw that if they went to the Western model, if they accepted the Western model, they saw even Christianity as freedom from the tyranny of these fake chiefs, illegitimate chiefs. So many people began to move toward it at that point. Then you had to change the name to become to go to the schools, missionary schools. You know, the same kind of thing they did with everywhere they went. Here, the Native Americans, they forced them to take English names, etc. All of that begins to set the stage for the erosion and ultimately the elimination of your cultural values, such that, you know, many people are looking for and fighting for a cultural renaissance in Africa, simply because they see, you know, it's to the point now where they see, the many people see the fallacy of the Western model as being a better model for the social structure. The same issues and problems that historically did not have socially, and we'll come back and discuss that when we talk about the social aspect next week. But, you know, let's just stop there because we're going a little long.
Okay. Brother, I am very, very thankful that you have, you know, agreed to do this series. And for everybody that's listening, this series is on the Asante model, and we're looking at different aspects. Tonight, we discussed politics and spirituality. And again, last week, Brother Orwa gave an overview of the whole series, and you can get an idea of what's to come. We have an archive system. If you're just tuning in, go back. All you have to do is just go back and scroll down the archives, and you will be able to listen to the previous interview with Brother Orwa that took place last Wednesday, and he will be back next Wednesday to discuss, you said, the social, Brother Orwa? Brother Orwa? Okay, well, everybody, if you're still there, Brother Orwa will be back next Wednesday to discuss another aspect of the Asante model. And so I want everybody to know that he's doing this series, and it's going to run about 5, maybe 6 weeks. And so, Brother Orr, are you back? Okay. So it'll be running for about another maybe 5 weeks. And so I want everybody to go back and listen to the archives. Also, Brother Orwa has done a series with us on the 11 laws of God. And so if you have not heard that series, go back into the archives. The 11 laws of God, we started with Amen and came all the way down through Geb. So I want to thank Brother Orwa. I guess, you know, the call must have dropped, but I want to thank him for his time, thank him for his patience, and thank him for agreeing to come on and share his wisdom with us. I do have a few announcements that I'd like to make. Are you familiar with Queen of Four? Well, Queen of Four will be my special guest tomorrow, Thursday, November the 19th. And that's going to be from 7 to 8 p.m. And we're going to be talking about lotus, love, and lavender. That's right. We're going to be talking about relationships. You don't want to miss it. This is part two of an interview that we did with Queen last Friday. That one was titled Fire and Desire. Okay, so this one is titled Lotus, Love, and Lavender. I'm about to let you know. Okay, so you don't want to miss that. That's tomorrow, Thursday, from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Make sure you tune in for that. Now, on Friday, we've got another series that we're just kicking off, and that's with Shechem Metanefer. Okay, and that is going to be on the five elements balancing Qi Gong. Okay, that's going to be about a 5-week series, and that's going to be every Friday until we're concluded with that. That's starting tomorrow. Again, that's Shechem Metanefer. Okay, so you don't want to miss that. That's starting on Friday. Now, I want to take a moment and thank all of the new followers that have been following on Blog Talk. We're getting a lot of new followers, and I just want to welcome everybody. If you're new to Health, Wealth, and Divine, thank you so much for tuning in. Please share this information with other people of like minds, because we're getting an education, and I just want to welcome you to the Health, Wealth, and Divine family. Also, everybody, on this Monday coming up, that is this Monday, November the 23rd, if you're up in the Washington, D.C. area, I'm going to be on the air on WPFW with Dr. Ted Watkins. We've got a health and wellness symposium coming up that you don't want to miss. That's going to be in Fort Washington, Maryland on December the 5th. There are too many people, far too many people dying unnecessarily just simply because of poor eating habits. If you can change the way you eat, you can change whatever condition you have. Okay, and so to that end, the Health and Wellness Symposium is going to be held on Saturday, December the 5th from 1 to 4 at the Metropolitan Outreach Worship Center, and that's going to be in Fort Washington, Maryland. And I will be on the air with Dr. Theodore Watkins, who's going to be one of the presenters at that symposium, as well as Brother Coy Dunstan. So I will be on the air at WPFW on Monday from 2 to 3, and that's 89.3 in Washington if you're in that area. Also, everybody, this Monday, same Monday, Brother Sanu Pura is going to be my special guest from 7 to 8 p.m. He's a regular on Health, Wealth, and Divine, and every month we cover a different aspect of Bazi astrology. And this month we're going to be talking about parenting. So if you're a parent or if you're a grandparent, then tune in to see how Bazi can help you when it comes to your parenting skills and what you can what information you can gauge just from even having a Bazi chart done on your child or your grandchild or your great-grandchild. As a matter of fact, have one done on yourself as well. But this show is going to be about parenting. So I want to make sure that everybody, make sure you tune in for that. That's Sanu Pura, and that's going to be on Monday, November the 23rd. So everybody, again, I want to say thank you. As always, you could be doing something else, but you chose to take time out of your busy day to spend it with myself and Brother Orwa Hehi, Metara, and Comet. Again, don't forget the archives. Also, if you want to leave me a message on Blog Talk, maybe just to let me know how you're enjoying the series, you know, what you'd like to see more of, you can the function allow you to leave me a message, and I will get it, and if I need to, I will respond. Again, thank you so very, very much. I don't take you for granted. I enjoy bringing this information to you, and I hope that you're enjoying it. So until the next time, don't forget, Queen of Fua, tomorrow we're going to be talking about relationships from 7 to 8 p.m. So I look forward to it, and I hope you do too. Until then, peace and blessings.